wolf on the hill is never as hungry as the wolf climbing the hill.
Lone wolf is a term commonly used by many people. It means that they used to belong to a group, but left, to become stronger. By thinking and acting alone, the lone wolf acquires superior cunning, agility, imagination and skills unknown to members of the pack. The lone wolf is independent of and distances itself from the petty bickerings, expectations, demands, mediocrities and unfulfilled dreams of other people, groups or organizations. The lone wolf is often branded as the rebel.
For it is the sovereign lone wolf who stands alone in all of his or her glory. You are listening to Lone Wolf Radio, presented and hosted by Tom Metzger. Tom is now broadcasting from a newly relocated and improved bunker.
Even though the lone wolf is on the move a lot, you can reach him. Yep, you can reach Tom Metzger at P.O. Box 1687. San Jacinto, California. That's S-A-N-J-A-C-I-N-T-O, California. 92583, and that's where you send your donations and any other literature or letters you would like for me to see. Well, how about this news? Mexico City, the Mexican government said on Tuesday, it profoundly laments the U.S. President Donald Trump's decision to phase out a so-called, allegedly popular program that shields hundreds of thousands of young, unauthorized, illegal aliens from deportation. The United States' southern neighbor will strengthen efforts to guarantee consular protections for affected Mexican youth, mestizos mainly, Mexico's foreign ministry said in a statement. A majority of the nearly 800,000 young men and women who were brought to the United States illegally as children and protected under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA, which the late Negro president dreamt up, are Mexican nationals, or some 625,000, according to Carlos Seda, Mexico's deputy foreign minister. Wow. They're exceptional. This is an emotional for the United States as for Mexico. This is as emotional for the United States as for Mexico, he said at a news conference immediately following the announcement to end the program, urging for a quick solution to the uncertainty that dreamers, as they are commonly called, no, they're just plain illegal aliens, now facing their adopted home. Oh, not adopted. They snuck in. Mexico will welcome migrants who opt to return to Mexico with open arms, Sada said, offering assistance with work, finances, and education. Well, why didn't you do that in the first place so they didn't have to come to the United States illegally? Why didn't you help get rid of NAFTA, which caused a lot of the problem? The U.S. announcement to end DACA, created by the former so-called President Barack Obama in a 2012 executive order, that's dictatorship, came during the final day of talks in the Mexican capital to modernize the North American Free Trade Agreement. Get rid of the North American Free Trade Agreement. That's what you got to do, Mr. Trump, but you're not going to do it, I'll bet you anything.
The world war is underway to a great catastrophe, not only for the Allies, that would be Great Britain, France, and Russia, but also for Germany and its ally, Austria-Hungary Empire, because of the blockade, famine. That is the larger frame for a story that is compelling from the moment it begins. We're going to go on a voyage with a submarine. It's called U-Deutschland. It's without weapons, and it sets sail the middle of June 1916 from Kiel to go up the canal and then head to the high seas. Dwight Messimer is the author. The book is The Baltimore Sabotage Cell, German Agents, American Traitors, and the U-Boat Deutschland during World War I. Dwight, congratulations and a very good evening to you. Captain Koenig of U-Deutschland, as it sets sail, what is his thinking? What is his mission? He has 25 enlisted men, 6 officers. What have they told him to accomplish as he sails to America? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Well, Paul Koenig's job was to get that U-boat from Kiel to the United States, carrying primarily aniline dyes that the American dye industry needed desperately, and the pharmaceuticals that were also needed here because Germany manufactured that stuff that nobody else could do as well or as much of. So they were bringing that. But they were there to bring back war material, raw materials for Krupp industries, nickel, iron, scrap iron, rubber, hemp, cotton, all kinds of stuff. They bought 800 tons of the stuff they were going to take back. And he was going to be the first of 8 boats that would eventually launch a regular transatlantic weekly trade to the United States, taking stuff that the United States needed and bringing back war materials that Germany needed.
So it was to be a commercial venture, and Krupp had built the boat, but it was built for a legitimate line, and there was a mask of this being entirely private. Correct, Dwight? And though it was obvious that these were healthy men on board and that Paul Koenig had a reputation as a officer in the German Navy, they maintained the pretense that this was a commercial enterprise for profit. Is that all correct?
The pretense part is absolutely correct. That boat belonged to the German Navy. The crew were Navy, so right out of fresh out of U-boats. Every officer on that boat had some active duty in the German Navy during the war.
It's a special boat in that it's been built without weapons, without torpedo tubes, without the routine of a U-boat that we think of in the Second War. This is the First War, 1916, and the technology was not advanced, and yet they had the concept. Mostly the boats ran on the surface. Very little time could be spent below deck. However, this boat was built with enormous amounts of room. That was for storage, both inside and outside. However, I learned from you right away, Dwight, that Paul Koenig, the captain, Captain Koenig, was unsure how it would handle at sea. And the moment he cleared for the seas, cleared Helgoland, he put it into a dive. What did he discover?
Well, what happened on that, actually, it wasn't right after they left Helgoland. They did their test dive, and the test dive confirmed that the boat was a very slow diver. So it took about 5 minutes to get completely under, which is way too long for a submarine that has to use, to be able to dive to escape attack. It's way too slow. So that was a problem, and then whatever was going to get him, he had to see it way before it got close enough that he couldn't get under. That was the first thing he found out. But then he found out when he got up off of the Faroe Islands and he did have to dive in a hurry, he lost control of the boat. He couldn't go under. In heavy seas, the boat was just too big and too buoyant, and he just couldn't get it to go under. So he tried to drive it under by hydrodynamics, going all ahead forward and down the bow planes and flood the ballast tanks and just literally drive her under, and he lost control of it.
And it handled very badly the whole time, and in no fashion was this a seaworthy U-boat. They were all at risk out there. Did they know that at the time?
Well, they found out when they went to sea. They didn't know it when they left Kiel. They were assured by Krupp that this boat is well designed. It's just a great big freighter that goes underwater and is act like any other submarine. But then when they got out in the ocean and they found out in heavy seas, they were on their own, they found out the boat had a lot of things wrong with it. First of all, it was built on the cheap. There was nothing, even the engines that drove that boat, the diesel engines, they weren't propulsion engines like manned diesels were in the big war boats. Those were diesel generators that were used on surface ships for auxiliary power on the ship. And the electric motors were not propulsion motors either. They were just oversized commercial electric motors that they used on cranes and dock equipment and stuff like that. But they worked, but they didn't move the boat very quickly. And maximum speed on the surface was 9.5 knots, which is very slow.
You note that it was underpowered. Its diesel was electric power. So they built a ship like it was like a lumbering freighter is what it was.
That's
It really wasn't meant to spend much time underwater. It was to be to evade the British, the Royal Navy defenses, and to reach America with a cargo hold. So, and there was no escort, and the British knew it was coming. That was a detail you provide us, that the British, we know Enigma's famous for the British getting a hold of the ability to read German naval traffic in the Second War, but they did it in the First War as well. They had the code book, Handelsverkehrsbuch.
Yes. And all three of them.
Did they know that, did the British, the Royal Navy know that U-Deutschland was at sea?
Oh, sure they did. She, like all U-boats, when she went north about, keep in mind this is a Navy boat. And when they left harbor and when they returned, particularly when they left Helgoland and returned to Helgoland, they performed just like a regular German U-boat would perform. They radioed their location and time departure when they left. Then when they were about at their maximum radio range, was about 200 miles, they sent a position report and a time so that the Germans would know at least they got that far.
And the Admiralty in room 40, which was their codebreaker, heard all of that.
Oh, sure they did. And they had radio direction by her, they triangled, they knew where she was. And then, of course, she went, from that point, she was on radio silence, not because they were being cagey, just they didn't have a radio that would reach that far anymore, so they were on their own.
This is early submarining in 1916, and we're headed to Baltimore. We're headed to land at Baltimore, and there's a spectacular reception waiting, but a detail here. Dwight mentions that they were looking to get supplies, tin and rubber and especially nickel. They needed all that because of the German blockade. They couldn't bring back food, but Germany at this point is starving. And you make note that the men in the front lines were very badly fed, and that would get worse in 1917. So we're looking at all of Germany hoping that U-Deutschland is successful. It wasn't going to bring food, but what? It would lift the sense of isolation? Is that what it would do?
Well, what they were hoping, the people actually believed. See, there's a lot of propaganda, both foreign propaganda that is aimed at the United States primarily, and there's a lot of internal propaganda aimed at the German people. And the Germans believed that they were going to bring back particularly powdered milk, because the milk was in a real shortage for little kids. They were going to bring back powdered milk, and they thought that they would bring back grains and things like that. They never, the population, the public, was unaware that boat was only going to carry war materials and coming back home. One thing I want to tell you, make sure you understand, people understand, is that I'm a part of the historical school of thought that says that the British won the war, or we won the war, because of the British blockade. It was very, very effective. And the Germans were starting to starve in 1915. But the German government figured that if they could just win the war quickly enough, if they had the war materials, they thought they could do that, then they would bust through this starvation period. It would be tough on people, but it wouldn't be a deal breaker, a war ender. and then turned out they couldn't do it.
The book is The Baltimore Sabotage Cell, German Agents, American Traitors, and the U-Boat Deutschland During World War I. Dwight Messemer is the author. When we come back, Messemer's new book is The Baltimore Sabotage Cell, German Agents, American Traitors, and the U-Boat Deutschland During World War I. It's 1916. U-Boat Deutschland, U-Deutschland, is underway, and it's headed to Baltimore. It will arrive and be received by considerably significant figures in espionage, in sabotage. This is the Baltimore Sabotage Cell. They put everything together. The shipping company, the receiving company, the people who arrange the dock and all of the stevedores, everything for the U-Deutschland, and including the media coverage, the press coverage at the time, are the same people involved in sabotage going on routinely. There's anthrax, there's glanders, they're setting storage facilities afire, and they're going to be a spectacular explosion before U-Deutschland sails again for Germany. But we need to introduce some of these figures, which are, you cannot make this stuff up. Dwight, Paul Hilken is the money man. He was born in 1878. He is extremely well-educated, Lehigh University, MIT, a naval architect. He is also a double agent for Germany. Why?
Well, there were a lot of Germans living in the United States, you know, just like there are a lot of other people who are immigrants living here. He was born in the United States, so he really wasn't an immigrant, but his parents were. And in those days particularly, the Germans tend to live in colonies, just like, you know, there are ethnic groups here in America who still live in colonies. We have Chinatown in San Francisco, largest outside of the Orient, as an example. But and they tend to maintain their own customs and their own interests. So when the war started, it was the Americans were neutral, and the Germans in this country were naturally and understandably pro-German. And Hilken had been a member of a naval intelligence agency called the Etappendienst, which we won't go into as it's really complicated, but they handled the naval side of the thing, and he'd been involved in that, what they call the Etappendienst cell in Baltimore for, golly, probably 10 or 15 years.
So he's a German secret agent. That's what he is.
Oh, yeah. He's an American businessman first.
Right.
You know, and then he works through the German consulate in Baltimore, and ultimately a German embassy in Washington, D.C.
Von Bernstorff is the ambassador, yes. So he knows Von Bernstorff. Von Bernstorff, he's the ambassador.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's an elite figure, but he's a secret agent. He doesn't give out a card saying, I'm a German agent, I'm working for the Kaiser. All right. He and his father have a business. They're extremely well-to-do, and they've set up the reception for U-Deutschland.
Yeah.
One other man he hires, however, Captain Friedrich Hinch, who's former Imperial Navy, German Imperial Navy Reserve Command. He is, at the beginning of the war, his ship is quarantined, is interned, kept in America, so he's out of work, and Hilken recruits him, Hinch, and Hinch is the sailing man who's going to receive U-Deutschland as it lands, but Hinch is also the operative, the agent extraordinaire who puts together the sabotage cell. He does everything.
And he's the straw boss for Hilken. The way it worked, the Etappendienst Navy runs this U-boat side of the operation. Section Politik, the Army, runs the sabotage side of the operation. Both operations are parallel but separate, entirely separate. Hilken is the only guy that brings them together under one hat, if you will. And he was very successful in keeping the two of them separated so that the operation of the U-boat was never compromised in any way. It really didn't. The U-Deutschland didn't bring any explosives to the United States. It didn't bring the anthrax. That was all brought in by Army agents who came through the blockade, coming to the United States with anthrax, glanders, explosives, incendiaries hidden in special luggage and things that got through the inspections, and they brought it to Hilken in Baltimore. Now, Hinch had been a part of active naval intelligence and Etappendienst in Havana, and he brought his ship into Baltimore when he was chased in by the British. So he was interned, and he was told, you contact Hilken, and he'll have a job for you. And when he by that time, Hilken had already been in contact with the German army through a guy named von Rentlin, known as the Dark Invader.
Yes, von Rentlin. He spends most of the war in the British authorities because they take him off a ship. We don't have time to go down that road, Dwight, although it's a wonderful story. All right.
Great story.
Hinch,
anyway,
Hinch puts together the reception of the tugboat that brings you, Deutschland, into Baltimore to tie up at the pier. That you have a photograph. There are wonderful photographs in Dwight's book of Hinch on board the tug, watching you, Deutschland. So Hinch, actually, you say he's Strawbaus. Sometimes he's a saboteur, sometimes he's a shipping agent. And when Paul Kern,
Hilken was the front man for the company, Eastern Forwarding Company. And he was the front man for A. Schumacher and Company, which was a tobacco import company. It belonged to him and his dad. And he's the guy who does all the press work on behalf of the Deutschland and stuff like that. Hinch is the guy who does the legwork. He's the one that organizes the stevedores who are going to be the saboteurs. He's the guy who organizes he went to New York and got the tugboat. And he did all the day-to-day operation. He was sort of the general manager, really. And of this operation, both sides of the operation.
And Hinch was also part of the saboteurs who put together something called cigars, which were delayed fuses they would toss on board ships, mostly out of New York, sometimes out of New Orleans. And you have records of 37 ships damaged or sunk because of Hinch's.
Yeah, you're right. That was 37 right there in that area that we know about. But there were 50 that. All together that are really unexplained.
So this is a wild ring. I mean, they're going in all directions. In addition, they're receiving you, Deutschland, with all of these headlines. That's what's spectacular here, Dwight. They invite the media, the press, to come forward. They give quotes.
Yeah.
They're visible all the time, and yet they're a major sabotage ring.
They were the most successful, active German sabotage ring in the United States in World War I. They were never discovered. None of them were ever arrested. None of them were ever brought to trial.
And they did escape spectacularly as well. They were chased. People knew about them, but they couldn't bring them to justice. Dwight Messemer is the author of a spectacular story. It's not lost. You can see it in the headlines. Read your New York Times, 1916. Everybody's fascinated. Why is the U-Deutschland coming here? What is this business about? Is this an enemy warship? Is it for us? And it goes all the way to Lansing, the Secretary of State. The President knows about it. In a moment, we're going to meet the wife of the Vice President of the United States, because this is a celebrity, U-Deutschland. The Baltimore sabotage cell, German agents, American traitors, and the U-boat Deutschland during World War I. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor. I'm going to put together a cargo U-boat built by Krupp. That's right. The same Krupp that builds all those weapons for the Second War built the U-boat Deutschland, captained by Paul Koenig, a former Imperial Navy officer. Actually, he's a present Imperial Navy officer, and crewed by a Imperial Navy crew that pretends it's private. And everybody in America is sort of fooled by this. And the newspapers come forward. Hinch is the man who's destroying ships routinely with delayed fuses. He's organizing strikes. He forms the Union of Russian Workers, and he hires stevedores. Hilken is the money man. He's looking to make a lot of money from the dye stuffs that come with you, Deutschland. It ties up. They start unloading, and Dwight, all of a sudden, there are in the news every day. Does Hilken want this? Does Hinch want this level of media coverage?
Well, they wanted the media coverage, yes, for the Deutschland operation, because one of the primary purposes of that boat and the concept was favorable propaganda for Germany in the United States, and the boat achieved that dramatically.
Right.
The thing about they were bringing aniline dyes. Over here, for our dye industry, the stuff they made clothing colors and things out of. And when the war started, the British imposed the blockade. Those dyes didn't get through anymore in America, and then the Americans suffered what they call an aniline dye famine, and we couldn't manufacture adequate amounts of synthetics replacements, and what we did wasn't very good. So we really wanted those dyes, and when they were willing to pay 10, 15, 20 times the pre-war price for the stuff just to get it, and the Germans could bring them. They could have brought, that's one thing that Deutschland could have done. It could have pretty well kept the American dye industry on its feet during the war. But so that was a big deal that they were bringing dyes. And then they brought pharmaceuticals with them, and one of the things they brought was a thing called Salvasan, which was an arsenic-based drug for treating syphilis. I guess they were having a syphilis problem at the time, and the Germans had this kind of draconian cure, but it worked. And they were also hoping that the Germans would bring over something that would take care of the current ongoing polio epidemic on the East Coast, but that didn't happen.
The Hilkins invested $332,000 in the dye, and they sold it, the estimate is, for more than $6 million. So they made a handsome profit. They have lots of money floating around here. Bernstorff, the ambassador, arrives to celebrate and gives out the announcement that there'll be a boat once a month. They are broadcasting as if this is going to be a regular occurrence. I mentioned the vice president's wife. She turns up while the boat's in Baltimore, and she wants a tour. She's welcomed on board. Spectacular headlines.
Hinch gave her a tour.
And Hinch, knowing he's the head of the sabotage ring, I keep right. emphasizing this because it's hard to believe. While they're loading nickel and rubber and tin and some rare earths, they need nickel. Krupp needs nickel to make the guns, to make the big weapons. While this is going on and they're being feted, and Paul Koenig is being seen dining at the Hotel Belvedere, and the reporters are paying 25 cents to stare from a window that can overlook the dock, all of this is going on. They're preparing the attack on August 29th, is my note here, July 29th. They are preparing to leave, but there's bad weather out there, and they'll be delayed a little longer. And news comes of the Black Tom explosion. Black Tom is the largest sabotage, I think, ever successful against the United States by an enemy power.
That's right.
Dwight, you record it was somewhere between 5 and 5.5 on the Richter scale. 100,000
right.
tons of TNT exploded in New Jersey. Who did the crime?
Well, that's a good question. It wasn't Hinch, and it wasn't Fritz Hermann. They were the two guys that organized it. There was a fellow they arrested that he died in prison, died of tuberculosis before they could ever actually make him. But he was
Michael Christoph.
He may have done it.
Michael Christoph may have done it, but he worked
Christoph,
for Hinch.
Yeah.
He worked directly for Hinch. He was Hinch's bag man. They carried around one suitcase full of plans and the other suitcase full of money. They were touring the country buying sabotage possibilities. Hinch is a wild character. He's just wild. He's totally out of control. And they set off, but it doesn't upset them. And Paul Koenig does not know that the man who's been helping him load and unload his ship is the man who organized the Black Tom. Is Paul Koenig ignorant of this?
He didn't have a clue about that sabotage or what those guys were doing. All he knew is he had to get that boat back and forth to Germany and put on a good show while he was there. No, you're right. I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
No, I understand. There are too many Pauls here. I'll stay to the final names. Hilken is the money man. Hinch is the straw boss. And Koenig is the captain. Now, they need to set sail. They've loaded up. They're ready to go. And they're going to leave. And at this point, the British and the French are very upset. They don't want them to leave. They want them to be contained in some fashion. America's a neutral. Do the Americans know that that tin is going to Krupp to make weapons? And so is the nickel.
Yeah.
Isn't that war material? Can't they hold them because of that?
Well, you got to think for a minute. The United States was selling ammunition, guns, and airplanes to the British and the French.
Right.
The American policy as far as trade wasn't during the early part of the war before we got in, was freedom of the seas, and we were a business country, we were allowed to trade with anybody we wanted to. And the American government had as much difficulty with the British blockade in terms of political dissatisfaction as they did with unrestricted submarine warfare. The big difference was the blockade didn't kill anybody, but the unrestricted submarine warfare did. And so there was a big moral difference there. But as far as trading with the Germans is concerned, unless you were a British sympathizer in the United States, you didn't care. You know, Germans lived here, thought it was a wonderful thing, and if America had not allowed them to trade with them in some way, with the submarine thing, for example, and it would have been a matter of a lack of neutrality. It would have been unneutral, as they would have said. That's true.
We're going to follow U Deutschland back all the way to its enthusiastic reception when it reaches Bremen in Germany. And the trip is not uneventful. There are lots of exciting details. Koenig is a great storyteller. We can't be certain if all of the scary moments are completely accurate, but it tells it's a whopper of a story. Before it reaches Bremen, however, the U Bremen, its sister ship, sails. What happens to it, Paul? What happens to U Bremen? Do we know?
Well, nobody knows. The best guess is that, like the Deutschland, she took what they call the northabout route. She went out of Helgoland up north around Scotland, up near the Faroes, turned down and came down across the Atlantic. She probably ran into the same situation off the Faroes that Koenig did the first time, and he probably had the same situation where he tried to dive, as we would say, crash dive in the Navy, I guess. And he had to crash dive, and he lost control of the boat. And in his case, he didn't recover, and they didn't hit bottom. They just went right down and it imploded. That's the best guess. There's no indication that she could have hit a mine somewhere, but that route was unmined. So it's unlikely that they hit a mine. And the nature of the conditions of what they call anti-submarine warfare, surface ships attacking submarines, was not well developed, and the British really didn't have much of an ASW capability, and they didn't record any event of sinking a submarine or coming in contact with a U-boat in that time or in that area. So in all probability, she suffered a diving accident or an engine or some kind of mechanical malfunction that caused the boat to sink with all hands.
U Deutschland reaches to, in a steady rain, very large crowds, the music Die Wacht am Rhein being played, an enormous celebration of Germany. The blockade is lifted as far as Germany's and the headlines are concerned. The Kaiser does not meet the ship. Why, Paul? Why, Dwight? Why weren't dignitaries there?
Well, there were some dignitaries there. Princess Sophia was there, but the thing is, the Kaiser didn't go because there was... Everybody in the government understood that the appearance had to be that this boat had no government connection. This was a private enterprise undertaking, and if the Kaiser went there, it would appear that there was something more to it than just, Norddeutsche Lloyd doing business with a subsidiary.
However, there was a celebration, a covered barge, and Wernher von Braun's dad was on board for the celebration that day.
He sure was.
So was the Grand Duke von Oldenburg, and the Captain Koenig was awarded the Knight's Cross. So he was celebrated. Everybody was celebrated. This begins an episode that's important, which is they're going to lay over, they're going to load up again, and they're going to head back to America. They're going to sail at the beginning of October. 8 October 1916. But the atmosphere is entirely changed since its celebration in July of 1916. And this time, they're not going to Baltimore. They're going to New London, where the same team, Hilken and Hinch, and their allies have arranged a pier in New London for U Deutschland. But as it docks in Connecticut, the temperament has changed somehow in America. How would you characterize it, Dwight?
Well, part of it was that the United States, our own propaganda here, the people who are anti-British in this country, largely the press by then, had made the Germans really look pretty bad, which I guess was pretty easy to do then, as far as the war was going on. And the there was a lot of talk about war guilt, and there was a lot of the submarine warfare thing had gone on, even though it was still a restricted warfare. There were a number of cases where passenger ships were torpedoed. There were even a couple of hospital ships that were torpedoed, and that did not sit well with the American people. And the other thing is, there aren't as many Germans, or weren't in those days anyway, down in New London as there were up in Baltimore. So you didn't have the ethnic support down there that you had up in Baltimore. I really don't know why he decided to go down there. When I read about it in the naval files and read the letters back and forth, I thought that's kind of a stupid decision to make. But But he did. I really don't know why he did it. But anyway, it was just a shift. It was just a shift in public opinion, and it was not as friendly when they got down there.
And so the second voyage of U-Deutschland, which will turn out to be its last as a cargo vessel, departs, and the departure is not without issue. There is a tug that runs in front of the ship, or the ship runs into the tug. Five hands are lost. Hinch is saved by accident. He's on board the tug, and there are what you'd have to say somber headlines saying goodbye to U-Deutschland. And when we come back, the fate of U-Deutschland and of these major players. The book is The Baltimore Sabotage Cell, German Agents, American Traitors, and the U-Boat Deutschland During World War I. It's American Traitors and the U-Boat Deutschland During World War I. The Deutschland returns. U-Bremen is lost. Deutschland is now scheduled to be converted into a U-boat, a large U-boat, but there will be others that were also built. It does not convert easily. It's still very hard to sail. It has three war voyages since 1917 into 1918. However, that is the story of U-Deutschland. The larger scale here is the decision about unrestricted submarine warfare. Dwight, if I understand the case that you put before us, the German Navy, the Kaiser, the command structure in Berlin, was faced with a dilemma. They were starving. The population, the army was starving. They needed to break the blockade. They built U-Deutschland, U-Bremen, and there were supposed to be other sister ships to break the blockade. When that failed, or appeared to fail, that left them with one option, which was unrestricted warfare, submarine warfare. Is that how they saw it? And Bethmann Hollweg, the prime minister, and von Jagow, the foreign minister, both opposed unrestricted submarine warfare. Is that all that correct, Dwight?
That's correct. That's right. Mm-hmm.
And so the decision, who decided? Because they knew it would bring America in. What a gamble they took.
Well, if you want to single name who decided, there were actually two names. It was von Hindenburg and Ludendorff. They were actually
running the army.
They were running the country.
Right.
They were running the war. They were in charge, and they had come to the understanding, and they were correct, that Germany was not going to win the war on the ground. That she was being outdone in terms of materiel. And you're right about people were starving. The winter of 1718 is known as a turnip winter because that's about all they had to eat. There was just nothing to eat. German army was actually sending out fatigue groups to gather nettles to make nettle soup with. They were the poorest fed army on the front in 1917 and 1918. So the answer then, the Navy said, well, look, we can do this with U-boats. We're building them faster, bigger, and better, and we'll have a bunch of them here pretty soon, and we can sink, 160,000 tons a month or something like that.
And the logic of that is that the British will starve with us? Is that what they were thinking?
Oh, yeah. They figured that they could. Yeah, when we entered the war and Admiral Sims showed up in London, he went to see the Admiral of the British Navy who was at the time, and the British told him that if they didn't find a way to contain the U-boats, they were going to lose the war, and they were convinced that they were on the ropes right there with the Germans, and it was just a matter of they had to find a way to.
So the decision then was to starve Britain, and both sides would starve. Wouldn't lift the famine in Germany, starving Britain.
Both
high commands, the governments, were making this decision to race together. To let their population starve. That's the risk. Who starves first? Who calls uncle first? And if I read correctly, by the time the Americans declare war April of 1917, we don't really get our contingent of soldiers there until 1918. It takes a lot of shipping.
That's right.
Do the Germans believe they can sink the transport ships?
That's right. They thought their claim was the Navy guaranteed them. Not an American trooper will make it to the...
But that's nonsense. That's nonsense. Did von Hindenburg and Ludendorff recognize that it was nonsense? By the winter of 1718, it was clear that the Americans were gathering in great numbers.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But in 1917, it made sense to them. See, part of the deal was when they converted the Deutschland to the U-155, those seven boats became what they call U-cruisers, very long range. They could go to the United States.
Right.
And the Americans and the Germans had already built some purpose-built U-cruisers. They had a whole division called the U-cruiser division that went to the Azores, went to the United States. And out there in that part of the ocean, there was no anti-submarine warfare, none, unless you count the convoys. Well, and most of the troop ships that we ran didn't run in convoys because we thought they were faster. They wouldn't have to worry about it. And had the Germans done what they should have done in World War One, yeah, they probably would have interdicted the American supply.
But the submarines, the long-range submarines, were not capable of chasing down a troop ship. It was impractical.
Well,
you have the facts.
Right.
They couldn't run it down. They were too slow.
Exactly. But you see, there had been a decision, been a recommendation in 1917, January, February, when the Germans started to convert their boats, these big cargo boats,
right,
as cruisers. There was this, look, let's make these things radio stations and surveillance, and form what, and they didn't call them wolf packs, they just called them attack groups, and they'll monitor the radio traffic and they'll direct these packs of U-boats into the lines of the army.
So it was science fiction then, Dwight. All of this was science fiction. They were proposing secret weapons or new weapon systems that were going to solve this, and yet they knew eventually, as we did, that the French army quit fighting after 17. I mean, they just didn't want to launch any more offensives. They'd lost too much. The British army was also exhausted and out of people to launch attacks until the American army arrives and reinforces the front in 1918.
That's right.
So the Germans the Germans created with their submarine warfare the conditions to lose the war.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's what Bethmann Hollweg had been saying for years. If you do this, you're going to bring the United States. He called her a sleeping giant. You're going to bring the United States into the war, and they will overwhelm us.
Dwight Messemer tells the thrilling but at the same time extremely upsetting story of the Baltimore sabotage cell, German agents, American traitors, and the U-boat Deutschland during World War One. Why is it upsetting? Because the famine that drives the U-boat Deutschland to America is the famine that convinced the German high command to launch unrestricted submarine warfare, bring America in, and create the conditions that we know now after the Versailles Treaty give us the catastrophe of the Second War. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show.
Well, there's a piece of history for you. I like to run these things because I know I enjoy them. But I don't enjoy them in the sense that whites setting up situations where they have mass destruction and mass death on each other. As you can see there, they were trying to out-famine each other. And the conditions in Germany were appalling, and you can read that in other books. And of course, as far as I'm concerned, the results of World War One led directly to World War Two. And for those who don't like Hitler, the war profiteers from World War One are directly responsible for the creation of Hitler. So that's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Wotan's Day.
Here, Your Majesty, we have an infant phenomenon. A remarkable child of 10. He's quite a historian. Editor of our school magazine.
Very interesting.
This, Your Majesty, is Rupert, our young editor.
How do you do, Rupert?
Thank you.
Sit down. And what's that you're reading?
Karl Marx.
Surely you're not a communist.
Do I have to be a communist to read Karl Marx?
Rupert, that's a valid answer. Well, if you're not a communist, what are you?
Nothing.
Nothing?
I dislike all forms of government.
But somebody must rule.
And I don't like the word rule.
Well, if we don't like the word rule, let's call it leadership.
Leadership in government is political power, and political power is an official form of antagonizing the people.
What magazine did you say he edits? A commentary on current events. But, my dear young man, politics are
necessary. Politics are rules imposed upon the people.
In this country, rules are not imposed. They are the wish of all free citizens.
Travel around a bit, then you'll see how free they are.
Yes, but you didn't let me finish.
They have every man in a straitjacket.
and without a passport, he can't move a toe.
But if you'll allow me to...
In a free world, they violate the natural rights of every citizen.
But you don't let me fully...
They have become the weapons of political despots.
Yes, but may I...
And if you don't think as they think, you're deprived of your passport.
Will you allow me
to... leave a country is like breaking out of jail.
Yes, but...
And to enter a country is like going through the eye of a needle.
But
am I free to travel?
Of course you're free to travel.
Only with a passport.
Will you allow me to say something?
Only with a passport. Do animals need passports?
Have you finished?
It's in Congress that in this atomic age of speed, we are shut in and shut off by passports.
If you'll shut up and let somebody else talk...
And free speech, does that exist?
No, you've got it all.
And free enterprise.
We were talking of passports.
Today, it's all monopoly.
All right. Now, will you...
Can I go into the automobile business and compete with the other trucks?
If I can get in a word...
Not a chance. Can I go into the grocery business and compete with the chain stores?
Will you shut up?
Not a chance. Monopoly is the menace of free enterprise. As I look back 60 years ago...
Where were you 60 years ago?
He was a glint in his great-grandfather's eye.
Very well now. Have you finished? Now let me say something. Let me tell you how wrong you are. In the first place... In the first place... Now I've forgotten what I wanted to say.
And the atomic bomb.
Ah.
It's a crime that when the world cries for atomic energy... You want to make atomic bombs.
Me? I'm against atomic bombs.
You want to wipe out civilization. Destroy all life on this planet.
You don't think you're living in the 90s.
I lost my throne because I didn't want atomic bombs.
You and your kind think that atomic bombs can solve your problem.
Listen, you little rat.
Today, man has too much power. The Roman Empire collapsed with the assassination of Caesar. And why?
If you...
Because of too much power. Feudalism blew up with the French Revolution. And why?
Right.
Because of too much power. And today the whole world will blow up. And why?
Because of too much power.
The monopoly of power is a menace to freedom. It degrades and victimizes every individual. And where is the individual?
I don't know.
Lost in terror because he's made to hate instead of love. If civilization is to survive, we must combat power until the dignity and peace of man are restored.
Well, that's from a movie entitled The Anarchist Kid, which Charlie Chaplin was in that movie. He's the one talking to the kid. Of course, Charlie Chaplin was a leftist. Some would say even a Marxist, but I certainly agree with much of what he said, and I agree with almost everything the kid said, and I think that he's closer to the mark than most people. Political parties, that's for sure. This is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, in the bunker right here in north central Indiana.